Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome this afternoon. My name is Jim Wunderman. I'm the president and CEO of the Bay Area Council. It's nice to have you here today. And for those of you who don't know the Bay Area Council, we're a business group, and we're here in the, have been in the Bay Area for 64 years. And the mission of the Bay Area Council is to promote a strong economic environment for our region as well as a great quality of life. We always have the second thing. We seem to go back and forth a little bit on the first thing, but on balance, I think we have a lot more to be proud of than we have to be concerned about. That said, we forge ahead and we work on a number of areas that are critical to our economy, our education systems from preschool through our research universities and everything in between, our transportation and mobility systems, our energy systems, our water, all the resources, everything it takes, all the components that make the Bay Area a competitive place. And one of the things that we've had for a long time is a partnership with the Bay Area Economic Forum, which was established in the late 1980s as a way for the business sector to partner with government and labor, as well as the academic institutions in the region to put together a table where the leaders of all of these important institutions could come together to not only determine our future direction, to actually execute strategy in that area. And a couple of years ago, the Economic Forum was merged and became part of the Bay Area Council. So today we operate as one. I'm going to introduce the president and CEO of the Bay Area Economic Institute in a moment, Sean Randolph, to speak with you. Before I do so, let me make a couple of comments. I want to thank, we're all here to talk about the Bay Area in India, another merger we're trying to forge, and we're going to talk about that today. I want to thank the Commonwealth Club for hosting this event, along with Ty, the Indus Entrepreneurs, for supporting this report and supporting the work this week in releasing it. And I particularly want to thank the Asia Society. I know many of you today came from the Asia Society for putting this, putting this release. We think this is very, very important work. Some of you I know from a few years back. I used to work for a company called Providian, which for the first 4 or 5 years I was there was the CEO was a fellow named Shailesh Mehta, who was one of the leaders of business in the Indo-American community in the Bay Area. And because I ran public affairs for the company, sometimes I didn't know whether I was actually Indian or not, because I engaged in a lot of activities with the community. And, you know, this is going back about 10 years ago and, you know, a few years after that. I sense the important emergence of the role India was playing economically and the partnerships that that actually existed anecdotally between our region and India. A whole bunch of Shailesh's friends were either CEOs or business leaders in some of the biggest and emerging companies in Silicon Valley and around the Bay Area. And it was obvious to me the increasing role that India was playing in our region. When I came to head the Bay Area Council back in 2004, one of the issues we grappled with then and we grappled with today was the issue around H-1B visas, because our region has been strengthened considerably by talent from places like IIT and elsewhere. It's one of the competitive advantages that we have. But the report that we're going to talk about today, it's the biggest report ever issued by the Bay Area Council Economic Institute. It's very large and heavy. I started to read it. It took, Sean will explain, it took a couple of years to complete it. And so far what I've seen is there's some amazing facts and analysis that's in the report. A lot of what we'll talk about today is where we head from here, but I would urge everybody to read it and access it and share it, and it's available online as well as in hard copy. So we think that this is very exciting as an organization that's all about enhancing our region's competitive advantages. We think that this relationship with India is one of the strategic things we have going that we have to build upon, and we think we can build on this report. We did the Economic Institute did a similar report in 2004 called Ties That Bind, report that explained the economic relationships between our region and the economy of China. And with that report in hand, we actually launched an initiative a couple of years later, a business partnership, if you will, before the Bay Area business community and the business economic communities associated with Shanghai and the greater Yangtze region. And that relationship has been budding and growing. And we actually plan to open up an office in Shanghai in the very near future. We think this report could be the precursor to such a relationship with India. It's probably a good accident that we're doing this as some of us prepare to head for India, led by Jim Herlihy, who's here today, and his team, who have helped with the strong support of Mayor Newsom, the San Francisco Bangalore Sister City Committee. And Jim, I think, is going to come up and talk about that in a little while. Jim's not only the head of that, but when I was a deputy mayor of San Francisco under Mayor Jordan, Jim was the chairman of the Library Commission at that time. And if he's half as good at running the Sister City Committee to Bangalore as he was at overseeing the city's libraries, I think we have good things in store. But you'll get to hear about that a little bit later. It's been a pleasure of mine to know Sean Randolph for quite some time. He is a great leader in our region. I'd say on all of the subjects that are involved in understanding economic relationships internationally, given his experience in the world of trade, all of the things I talked about that make the Bay Area competitive, transportation, infrastructure, and so forth. Sean's an expert on all of these different things, and having him here in our region is a great strategic advantage in itself. It's a tremendous amount of work to put together a report like this, which Sean personally edited. And you'd think that you could kind of work on a report, and that's what maybe Sean did for the last couple of years, but that's not the case. This was one of many important projects that have been turned out by the Institute under his leadership, and I won't take you through all of the weeds on the things that he and the Institute do, but it's extremely impressive, and I'd urge your attention to the work of that Institute because it's going to have a lot to say about our future here. So he's got a list of academic credentials I also won't go into because it would kill the time we have for the panel that we have later. But take my word, he's an extremely educated person and very, very dedicated to the work that he does and to this place we call home, the Bay Area. So with that in front of you, let me introduce the president and CEO of the Bay Area Council Economic Institute, Dr. Sean Randolph.
Well, thanks very much, Jim, and thanks, everybody, for being here and for starving yourself for an hour and a half. Maybe you'll enjoy lunch even more when we're done. So before we get into it, I want to, again, thank, as Jim did, our partners in this event, the Indus Entrepreneurs Thai, the Commonwealth Club of California, and the Asian Society of Northern California, and especially the club for making this great room available for us today. And I also want to thank the report sponsor. And I really want to pause on this because they've been critical to our efforts to get this together. If we didn't have their support, we wouldn't have a product to talk about today. Their logos are on the board out front. So as you go by later on, please stop and stare and just memorize them because they have really stepped up to the plate on this one. And they are FedEx, HCL, San Francisco International Airport, Lufthansa Airlines, Visa, Accenture, Draper International, Gensler, Intergy, Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, Silicon Valley Bank Financial Group, Salesforce.com, the Taj Campton Place Hotel, and Xander Group. So we thank them very, very much for actually making this project possible. With that, let's get into the report. I'll give you about a 15-minute summary, then we'll really dive in with the panel. As Jim mentioned, this particular report took 2.5 years to do. We published our report that Jim mentioned on the Bay Area in China in November 2006. A lot of things have come out of that. We started work on this in April 2007, and so it's been a while. About 200 interviews went into this, about 150 here in the Bay Area, about another 50 in India in the course of a couple of trips. The more we looked, the more we found. And the reason it's so big, we finally cut this thing off at 295 pages because the more you look here in the Bay Area for connections to India, they just keep coming up. And it's very low key. It's not really widely recognized, but I think we could have gone on another year and still turned up more that was worth talking to. But in the process, we met or talked with almost all the leaders. We never get everyone, but almost all the leaders in the Indian business community here in the Bay Area, many of the leaders in the Indian community in general in the Bay Area, and nearly all, certainly most, of the Bay Area companies that have an active presence or involvement in India by way of active Indian partnerships, R&D centers, or other kinds of offices in India. So this is really based on the perspective of the people who are doing the business, who are actually making these relationships meaningful. So the Bay Area's economy is really built to a large degree on its global ties. We have an enormously complex web of relationships with countries around the world that help make our economy what it is today. Many of our area's leading companies get 60, 70% or more of their total revenues from selling to overseas markets as opposed to domestic markets. And many of our companies are very active in overseas investment, and we are the recipients of huge amounts of foreign investment coming into our community. And that kind of foreign investment really anchors us very, very deeply in the rest of the world economy. But maybe the most important way we connect to the rest of the world is through people. We've been enormously successful, more so than anywhere else in the country, I think, at attracting a globally diverse and very, very high-end workforce of executives, of scholars, research people, technicians, and others who have really had enormous roles shaping our economy here for many, many decades. So India, when you look at where they're coming from, India is one of a handful of countries that I think most everybody would agree is going to have a powerful impact on what our economic future here is going to look like. And the good news for us here, and there's a lot of bad news these days, but the good news for us is that our relationships here with India from the Bay Area are unique in the entire United States. They're qualitatively different from what you find anywhere else in the country, perhaps even anywhere else in the world. And that's a unique connection. It's a point of leverage that can really benefit us tremendously in the years to come. So like all connections, there are two ends to it. So here in the Bay Area, as I mentioned, we've benefited from waves and waves of Indian immigration. The first wave came in the 1850s. You had people coming by sea from India. You had Sikhs coming down from Canada. This was during the days of the British Empire. A lot of them settled in the Central Valley, especially around Sacramento, where there's a very vibrant Indian community to this day. They became very big in agriculture, and today, descendants from India, from those first migrations, produce about 95% of the valley's peach crop, 60% of its prune crop, 20% of its walnuts and almonds, big export crops. And so there's a deep heritage here, very quiet, but a deep heritage going back into more than the last century. But the most important immigration for us here, I think, really happened in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. And it was really stimulated by the space race and by the Cold War and by Y2K. And in those years, the U.S. government really started to call on scientists from all around the world to come and contribute to its efforts as the Cold War was getting in gear. Sputnik was a challenge. We invited scientists from the U.K., but they also started to come from India here into the Bay Area. They came to all of the U.S., but as it turns out, the most ambitious, the most entrepreneurial of them came here to the Bay Area. I think they were attracted by a very tolerant, socially tolerant climate we have here in the region, and obviously they were attracted by the entrepreneurial opportunities we have here in Silicon Valley and all around the region. So by 1986, about 20 years ago, nearly 60% of all graduates from the Indian Institutes of Technology were migrating overseas, primarily here to the Bay Area. By the mid-1990s, about 10 years later, nearly a quarter of Silicon Valley's engineers were Indian. Nearly half of them had advanced degrees, and about 15% of all the technology startups in Silicon Valley had been started by people from India and had Indian CEOs. So for any of you who are from the Indian community, I don't have to tell you that many of those enormously successful entrepreneurs cashed out, had very high valuations for their companies, and rather than going to play golf, they've become serial entrepreneurs. They have started multiple companies, and many are now venture capitalists, supporting another generation or even two generations of startups. And so their overall impact really has helped to make our community here what it is economically, and I'm always sort of amused sometimes watching Bollywood films where they're in New Delhi or someplace and they're talking about cousin so-and-so who's coming from San Jose. So there's this huge human flow back and forth that's part of that picture. So that involves a very vibrant Indian community here in the Bay Area. There's about 250,000 people from India who live here in the region, making this the largest Indian community in the United States after New York and New Jersey area. And by absolutely any standard, it's wildly successful. The median income is about $107,000. 75% of adults have advanced degrees or at least a bachelor's degree. 70% are professionals or in management, and nearly half of them are homeowners. So that's a pretty good record. And reflecting that, there's a very vibrant base of community and professional organizations here in the region. There's a lot of them. There's the Indian Community Center, which is down in the South Bay, the Global India Venture Capital Association, the American India Foundation, the Indo-American Council, lots of others. The one that I would really point to, I think most of you probably know it, is the Indus Entrepreneurs, or TAI, that began really as a monthly networking meeting, series of dinners, really, in the early 1990s. And since then, it's grown to be a global organization with 53 chapters, 11,000 members in general, 1,800 core charter members in 12 countries. So home base, ground zero for TAI is right here in the Bay Area. So aside from these organizations, cultural organizations, business organizations. Another critical connector here has been our university system, again, one of the best in the world, which helps also make our economy what it is. And one of the key roles the universities play is to attract some of the best and brightest from all around the world here to our community. So India is the leading country of origin in the world for foreign students coming to California. For this study, we estimated that about there may be 3,500 undergraduate and graduate students from India here in the Bay Area. There's probably 400 visiting scholars at our university here in the Bay Area from India. Most or nearly all are at the graduate or postdoctoral level, working in especially in fields like computer science, engineering, and business. Many of our leading campuses also have very strong India programs, to the point where the Bay Area is probably the leading center in the United States in the university community for India-related research. Point, for example, to the Berkeley India Initiative, the South Asia Initiative at Stanford, the Satyajit Ray Film Center, and the new South Asian Studies Center at UC Santa Cruz. So together, the universities have been and continue to be magnets for talent. A lot of these folks stay and contribute to our economy. So that's the Bay Area side. There's obviously very strong connections and impacts we have in India. In fact, one of the findings of the study is that no place else in the United States comes anywhere close to the density and the intensity of the connections, especially the economic and business connections that we have in India. So Bay Area technology firms were among the very first in the United States to recognize India's economic potential. Nearly every major technology firm in the Bay Area right now has an R&D center or some other kind of facility in India, typically in cities such as Bangalore, Pune, and Hyderabad. Or they utilize Indian resources through Indian IT firms or other global IT firms that have a strong presence in India. And those engineers, either employed by Bay Area companies or employed by various partners, are contributing in increasingly important ways to the development of the products that those companies are developing for global markets, but also increasingly for India's own domestic market. And I'll have a little bit to say about that in just a second. At the same time, Bay Area venture capital firms, as they started to look around the world for opportunities, have dropped anchor in India in a very big way. and they're investing in startups there, ranging everywhere from online gaming to healthcare services. So a big area of activity for venture investment just getting going. So there's just a huge amount to be said for what the companies are actually doing. I'll just give a couple of examples. I'll rattle them off. That gives a flavor for just the depth of what's happening and the diversity. So Visa, based here in the Bay Area, has issued more than 30 million debit cards and 32 million credit cards to Indian consumers. India is Oracle's fourth largest global market and accounts for its largest investment in the world outside of the United States. They have a workforce of 24,000 there, and Oracle has more than half of the total market share for India's relational database market. And that includes 80% of India's banks, 6,700 technology and applications customers, and an online developer community, something above 700,000. India hosts Symantec's largest engineering workforce outside the United States. They perform work on more than 80% of Symantec's products. India accounts for a third of Adobe's global engineering workforce. Cisco's second global headquarters is located in Bangalore. More than half of India's developer community of about 740,000 works on Sun platforms. Hewlett-Packard is the single largest player in India's computer market. Levi Strauss has 450 exclusive outlets in 80 Indian cities. Architectural and urban planning firms such as Gensler and Skidmore, Owings & Merrill are working on projects there ranging from the design of the new Chennai airport to replacement housing for tens of thousands of slum dwellers in Mumbai. eBay counts 2 million regular users in 670 cities. Across India, 10,000 dealers, and there's an item sold every minute on eBay's India website. India's Yahoo's base for global product and service development that's aimed at developing and emerging markets. In the area of venture capital, San Francisco-based venture firm Draper International was the first U.S. venture firm to launch an India-dedicated fund. Silicon Valley Bank here in the Bay Area led the major migration of U.S. venture firms into India with an exploratory trip of venture leaders they organized in 2003. Evolvent's Life Science, India Life Science Fund is the first India-dedicated fund focused on biotechnology, again, a Bay Area fund. And right now today, there's more than 40 Bay Area venture firms that have either Indian leadership or significant activity in India. So that's just a slice of what's going on. And our takeaway from looking at all of that was that this is a really different image of India than most people think of. I think you ask most people, so India, what would you say? Oh, they would say, well, it's a place for call centers and where back office and other service jobs get offshored. And there are two major trends that we found out of this report that I'll just tag really briefly because they are different from that image, and it's really important that we understand them. One is that while traditional offshoring, what I just mentioned, continues, and India continues to offer significantly lower costs than we have here, its one-time advantage, its one-time cost advantage has really shrunken a lot. It's down from 80% a few years ago to 50% today. Now, that's still a lot. But we're seeing the cost margin between India and here in the Bay Area especially declining. So recognizing that India's IT firms are, every one, trying to move up the economic ladder as fast as they possibly can, taking on higher value kind of activities, taking on increasingly complex roles such as system integration and end-to-end product development. And as they're doing that, they're kind of moving from a contractual model, the offshore model, toward more of a partnership model where Indian engineers, whether employed by Bay Area companies or other companies, are becoming more and more deeply embedded into the entire global networks and global strategies of many of our major companies. The trend, then, it is really starting to show some signs of producing capabilities and alliances between Bay Area and Indian companies and Indian resources on a global scale, where I think Indian engineering talent with the capital we have available and the innovation here you know, may very well one day, we would hope, dominate global service markets. We're starting to see some similar shift, and we'll hear more, I think, from our panel on this in just a moment, in India's biotech and life science sector, where locally performed clinical trials are helping to extend the capital available to a lot of our biotech firms. You know, you're running a long time on your invested capital before you can get a product to market. So doing these clinical trials in India is helping extend that and accelerating the time available for getting their products into commercial markets. So while it looks like India's biotech sector is still pretty small, certainly compared to where we are here, they're building on their historical strength in biopharmaceuticals and generics to move into higher value-added activities such as discovery research, more and more in partnership with our companies here. So again, biotech is also seeing this move upscale from a pure contract relationship into more of a partnership relationship. The second major trend we're finding coming out of the report, a pretty obvious one, but it's the development of a very significant domestic market in India. And that's based on a growing middle class, depending on how you count them, somewhere between 200 and 300 million people, not that much less than our population here in the U.S., that have disposable income, money to spend on a variety of things, especially consumer goods. And increasingly what we're finding is that Bay Area companies are in India not just to develop products and services for the U.S. or for global markets, but more and more also or primarily for domestic markets in India. And reflecting that, more and more, even most, I think, of our venture capital companies that are now in India and investing in India, either through general funds or India funds, are actually, they're not investing as much in IT, some are, but they're investing more and more in companies making things for India's own domestic consumer markets. So this emergence of India as a global player, as a partner rather than just a contract source, as a market, it offers some really important opportunities but also some challenges for us here in the Bay Area. I think you can sense the opportunities, the global partnerships, the markets, all the growth. The challenges really have to do with people, and I think it's important that we recognize that talking about what the future is going to look like. So I think the report makes a very strong case, you know, if you read it, I'd be interested to know if you agree or not, that doing work in India does not necessarily come at the expense of U.S. jobs. And in fact, we found talking to many companies, sometimes it actually frees companies here to be more competitive because they'll move some of the core, more routine business activities, very important, but the legacy stuff in India, and that often will free up the work they do here to focus on innovation, new product development, the next generation of activity. We also found quite a bit of evidence that the utilization of engineers in India and other people in India is to a significant degree due to our failure here in the U.S., to produce an adequate number of engineers coming out of our higher education systems. You know, you go into the graduate departments in electrical engineering in Berkeley or Stanford or other places, they're mostly from India and China. They're not from here. And that's a significant issue for the future, not that they're occupying our graduate departments. We really need them very badly, but we have not succeeded for many, many years in generating enough domestic engineers and people with those skills from here within the Bay Area and the U.S. But the issue remains whether California and the Bay Area and the U.S., in fact, can you continue to partner with places like India and compete with places like India, because we do both, if we fail to maintain the kind of globally competitive workforce that we've benefited from here for so many years. And there's two issues there. One is that many educated Indians who over the last 30 years have come here and many, 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 if not most, have stayed. They've gotten their graduate degrees. They came with engineering degrees, and they've become part of our community. They've become part of our business base. And as we said earlier, they've helped to make Silicon Valley especially what it is. But now, some are starting to go back. And more of the students who are coming for advanced degrees, and they're still coming, are coming not with the idea necessarily of staying indefinitely and being part of our economy indefinitely, but getting the degree or staying a few years, get some experience, and go back to India. And why is that? Well, entrepreneurial activity and opportunity is growing there. There's just, it's laying around the landscape to be picked up. And also, and you know, to some degree, more so than here. The other issue, though, is we have a really outdated immigration policy that is essentially designed to keep people out. And so it fails to differentiate between less educated migrant workers coming from Central Central America or Mexico, to distinguish that from the kind of highly educated immigration that has especially benefited the Bay Area, people coming with advanced degrees, coming to our universities, who are really delivering tremendous value for our economy. So if you're an Indian and you got a degree from Berkeley or Stanford, a PhD or a master's degree, and you want to make a life here, you want to found a company, you want to work here, you want to be part of this community, you may have to wait as long as 5 years just to even have your application for a green card considered. In the meantime, people at home are saying, hey, come on back. We got opportunity here. Well, it's putting people in a tougher spot. And so Annalise Saxenian from Berkeley has talked about brain circulation, people moving in both directions, just like we're seeing now with China. And that's a great thing. We benefit from brain circulation, as does India. But we need to continue to focus, and focus better than we have at the national level, on how do we make this an attractive place for highly talented, educated people from India and elsewhere in the world to come and stay and contribute to our economy. The second issue relating to people in the workforce really has to do with the quality of math and science education in our own schools, K-12 especially, to ensure that Americans are, again, prepared to both cooperate and compete with their Indian counterparts. So investment in institutions of higher education like University of California, but this also includes our community colleges, our California State University system, is essential to ensure that we're in a position here to compete based on innovation and cooperate based on innovation. And the truth is that if our students lack the skills that are increasingly now found in other countries, such as India, if our workforce lacks the ability to respond to the tides of innovation and to changing markets, and if we fail to fund our public universities, and that's a very real threat with the state's budget crisis right now, our ability to hold our own in the future with countries like India and China is going to be increasingly at risk, and we will pay the cost then in terms of jobs and growth. So to summarize, draw a bottom line under all of this, I'd say the report finds that the Bay Area's ties with India are unique in the country, unique in the world. They're at a higher level, and what the Indian community is doing here is that qualitatively different from what we find elsewhere. And in a very globalized world economy now, this and India's economic trajectory again, along with China, they're the only major economy that actually is growing strongly right now, gives the Bay Area a tremendous opportunity to expand its global reach. If we think strategically, and if we keep our doors to the world open, and if we continue to invest in the strengths that have made us here a global center for science, business, and innovation. So that's 295 pages in 15 minutes. There's gory detail in the book itself, which I encourage you to take home and absorb. With that, I want to invite, for just a minute, Niels Eric. So Niels was the co-author on this report. He has also been working on it for 2 years, and he did many of the interviews related to it, and I think Niels will have a couple of thoughts from his perspective on where this points us for the future. So Niels, wherever you are.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Sean and the council for the opportunity to work on this project. It's really been a fascinating job over a period of time. Reports like this don't typically get done. When you look at a subject like this, you tend to see reports that are perhaps this broad in what they cover and this deep, or they focus on something narrow and go perhaps this deep. And when you try to strike a middle ground, you end up with 295 pages. But the idea is, and we found this to be the case with the China report, that you start to connect dots that no one saw before. You start to unlock insights about the relationship that people didn't envision. And you start to create opportunities because as people go through it looking at their specific areas of interest, they start to connect specific dots and they start to have an understanding of who they might contact and where there might be possible synergies and things like that. It has led to some interesting opportunities as far as China is concerned, and hopefully it'll do the same as far as India is concerned. Just a couple minutes. I wanted to talk about the one thing that struck me overwhelmingly in the course of doing the research and doing the interviews for this report, and that is the complementarity of the relationship between the Bay Area specifically and India. And I guess I'm thinking more of Silicon Valley than anything else. But when we listen to the stories of Indian engineers and entrepreneurs who came here, and they have a very good undergraduate school system, but a relatively thin graduate, postgraduate system. And so many of the people who come here, what they're looking for is they're looking for a master's or PhD and then going on to a job. But the interesting thread with all of them was they all say some version of, I come from a place where very little on a day-to-day level works the way it should. The transportation doesn't, the power comes in and goes out, the water is there or it's not, it's clean or it's not. I have difficulty finding suppliers for what I want to do. I have difficulty with materials. If I do find this, I have difficulty with financing, particularly if I'm a small business. The bureaucracy is overwhelming. I don't want to scale up past a certain size because I'll then fall under a whole other set of regulations, which will be crippling. And the IT and software industry was able to avoid that. And then they say, I get to Silicon Valley, and all of a sudden, everything I wanted to do is easy. And all of a sudden, the labs, the university connections, the research facility connections, everything seems to fall into place. And ideas start to become real. And that chemistry, I think, is central to this. It runs throughout what we talk about in the report. And I'm sure that the panelists that follow we'll talk more about that. But unlocking that is very important. And also, from our standpoint, when we look at issues like energy, we're all talking now about a smart grid that's going to involve distributed energy, so it's going to decentralize how we produce this. In India, what people are looking at is there's an entrepreneurial view of everything, which is, how do I make something simpler? How do I make it more affordable? How do I make it more accessible? How do I make it more productive? And when you look at what's been done with technology and innovation, that's really going to be central to innovation going forward, I think. And so we have a lot to learn in a lot of areas of cooperation, and so I think it's worth everybody really examining that in whatever your area of interest is, and look forward to what the panelists have to say. Thank you.
Thanks, Neil. So we'll start to turn the corner now, kind of looking ahead, and I think the first thing ahead is coming up in about a week. So I'd like to invite Jim Herlihy, who's the co-chair of the San Francisco-Bangalore Sister City Committee, to come up for a moment and tell us about the delegation's trip next week.
Good afternoon. I'm Jim Herlihy. I'm the co-chair of the San Francisco-Bangalore Sister City Committee. And you might be sitting out there saying, how would somebody with the name James Patrick Herlihy be co-chair of the San Francisco-Bangalore Sister City Committee? A little bit of background. Mayor Newsom, in fact, had the vision and the goal and the objective to create this sister city back in 2005. He and I were both at the tail end of a mission to Shanghai. It was our 25th anniversary of the San Francisco-Shanghai sister city relationship. And just based on how successful that relationship has been, how strategic it has been to both to San Francisco and to the opening up of the Chinese economy, Mayor Newsom felt that a similar kind of relationship with Bangalore, and specifically Bangalore — he didn't focus on any other city, and of course for many of you, you know that Bangalore is the Silicon Valley of India — he focused on that. It was about 3 years of work, traveling back and forth, identifying the right parties in Bangalore. And initially, we were somewhat taken aback that Bangalore did not immediately jump out of its chair and welcome the opportunity to have San Francisco as a sister city. But we worked through that. And in 2008, October of last year, Mayor Newsom, in a video conference, signed the memorandum of understanding with his counterpart in Bangalore, and it was witnessed by the chief minister of Karnataka State. India, as you know, is a federal system with 26 states. Karnataka is the third largest state, and Bangalore is its capital, third largest state, judged by industry. For those of you who may not be familiar with the sister city concept, a little bit of history. San Francisco has 14 sister cities. The very first sister city was created in 1956. President Eisenhower approached Mayor Christopher and requested that San Francisco and Osaka become sister cities. The concept was citizen-to-citizen diplomacy for several purposes. Number one, it helped to reintegrate the Japanese-American community back into the civic life of San Francisco and the Broader Bay Area. Number two, the relationship between San Francisco and Osaka, beginning in the mid-1950s, began to facilitate investment, commerce, education, cultural exchanges. We all know how successful Japan has been throughout the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. Similarly, as China opened up and the United States recognized the People's Republic of China in 1979, Mayor Feinstein was approached to create the first sister city relationship, the very first sister city relationship between an American city and a Chinese city. And that was in 1980. Again, cast your mind back to where China was in 1979, 1980. Look where it is today. The mayor and our committee views India with a similar level of excitement, eagerness, enthusiasm, and clearly India is quite a few steps ahead of where China and the United States was in 1980 or Japan and the United States was in 1956. Our delegation will leave on Friday. There are 44 of us. It's a trade and commerce delegation. There are 44 of us who comprise the delegation leaving from the Bay Area. There are another 13 of us who will join us in Bangalore. The first day, Monday, November 30th, a week from today, will be our government day. We'll be received by the chief minister. We will sign a total of 9 technical agreements, technical cooperation agreements. We call them memorandums of understanding, ranging from biotech, UCSF, and Biocon, which is India's Genentech. We'll sign a research and development and cooperation technical agreement. We will also have MOUs in the area of wastewater management, solid waste treatment, urban forestation, among others. Healthcare, very important, neonatal healthcare, women's health care, women's issues. Another important part of our – we tried to get Mitch Katz to come on our trip. Unfortunately, Dr. Katz is busy with H1N1 flu and got his hands full with quite a few health issues here in San Francisco. In any case, we will come back with 9 technical cooperation agreements between the City and County of San Francisco, between the Asian Art Museum and its counterparts in India, UCSF, and Biocon, among others. We see this as the beginning of a citizen-to-citizen relationship. We also see it as an opportunity to identify for not only for the largest companies. The largest companies in the Bay Area have identified the opportunity that India represents, both on the software side, on the research side, venture capital, private equity, et cetera. What we also hope to do through the sister city relationship is to open that route, as people in the Middle Ages looked for the route to India. We'll be blazing that route ourselves this coming weekend. But we want to open that route to mid-sized companies, many companies who up to this point have not had the opportunity or not had the resources, the wherewithal, to even consider exporting and taking on opportunities in India. Included in our delegation on the third day, we will have an investment and commerce day, which is going to be hosted by Thai. We will have representatives of infrastructure engineering companies here from the Bay Area, construction companies. Mayor Newsom on a second day, in fact, is going to be inaugurating on the Cisco campus the first LEED compliant energy efficient building in India. So I know we all want to get on to the panel. I'm delighted that Mayor Newsom is traveling with us, and yes, indeed, he is traveling with us. He's not going to Hawaii, and we will come back hopefully to this body and report to you about our first steps in forging this new relationship between San Francisco and the Bay Area and Bangalore, India. Thank you very much, and look forward to working with you in the future.
Thanks, Jim. So I'll invite our panel to come up, and we'll jump right into it. I should say that another first for us at the Bay Area Council and the Institute is we're going to be presenting this report in Bangalore at the investment forum that the Sister City Group will be having on the 2nd, and then 2 more presentations in New Delhi the day after that. So we thought this was a strong enough story. We should take it to India as well. So more on that. You all have the bios in your packet of what our panel is. And for those of you who don't know them, I think we're really, really privileged. And I'm not kidding at all about this, that this is a phenomenal group of people who know India extremely well, both broadly and also from the standpoint of their industries and their companies and their professional engagement over many, many years. So I'm not going to repeat everything in their bios, but I would encourage you to look at them because it's hard not to be impressed. But we've got a terrific spread from Vivek Paul, who's an investor. He's been with Texas Pacific Group in private equity, very, very deep history in the IT sector in India and its development. We have Arjun Batra, director of Intel India, very deep in semiconductors, which is, of course, a huge industry for us here in the Bay Area. Sandeep Kishore from HCL, one of India's leading homegrown IT firms and the first major one actually to drop anchor here in the Bay Area many, many years ago. Kaiser Mullah-Feroz, who's with Salesforce.com right here in the city, one of our best and actually one of our best performing software companies right now. Nandini Tandon from Lumira Capital, deep background in biotech and biotech investing now in India, and Michelle St. Pierre from one of our leading architectural firms, Gensler, that's now very active in India and has a great perspective on the challenges and the opportunities from where we sit here for urban development in India. So I'm going to ask each one, starting with Vivek, to say 4 or 5 minutes about how the world looks from their standpoint, either reflecting on the report or their experience, their perspective, really about the future of India's economy and how we might relate to it. And when they're done, we'll open it up for questions. Vivek.
Thank you. First of all, it's a great personal pleasure to be here. Having done the Bangalore to San Francisco run for many, many years, I truly feel it's great to see so many other people also interested in that link. So I think that as an investor, it's very simple when you think about investing in India and in the technologies that are emerging out of Bangalore, which is you have a population where you have 55% of the people that are under 25 years of age. This, to me, is like the post-World War baby boom in the United States. You know, you would have to seriously mess it up to get your investment strategy wrong. Everything's going to rise. So I think that as a result, you just have one single factor that's fundamentally driving it. Having said that, I think that as a result of this, the themes that we're looking at, which are consistent with, I think, what the report also said is that India itself is growing as a large market. And so we're really interested in Indian consumers and Indian corporates. So what's happening is that what we are seeing is that whether it's in IT spending or whether it's in consumer spending, India as a market is actually rising and beginning to, in some sense, compete with other consumers in the world for the fixed amount of goods that we have. So I think that that's one theme that we would love to be able to take forward. The second is, what you heard earlier about the circulating brains. So what we've seen is that while India has a lot of technical talent, in some sense the limitation has always been you had to tell that talent what to do. So it wasn't able to come up with that idea by itself. And now what we're seeing is there are so many great entrepreneurs who cut their teeth here in Silicon Valley who are now going back to India. And interestingly, not just Indians. I mean, not just people from Indian origin. It's really people who are who are ambitious, who want to go where the new markets are. So we're seeing that, and that's another really interesting theme for us to invest in. And the third is India as a gateway to the neighboring areas of Asia Pacific and the Middle East. So what's interesting is that India has actually become a great way by which you can actually reach out to those markets. One of the things that I was surprised about was I was in Vietnam and I was talking to this Vietnamese company, and they talked about how they were coming to India to sell business. And I said, gee, I didn't realize that India is buying so much business from Vietnam. They go, no. The guys who make the decisions, like the Cisco guys in India, make the decisions for all of Asia Pacific and the Middle East. So it was really interesting that what we're seeing is some interesting themes coming up. So I think that all said, this linkage between where the people are, as I mentioned, 4 billion people, whatever the number is, just continues to rise, billion people, and the capital here. And so I think that it's great for me, very exciting, to be able to manage what you can see coming out of capital as well as labor that can come up in the future. A couple of other things that I just wanted to mention quickly in my allotted time. One is the report, amongst all things, was actually very flattering on me on two counts that are actually not true. So I just wanted to make sure that I didn't get myself overstated. One is I'm not on the board of the Computer Science Corporation. And the second is I'm not a co-founder of Wipro. Wipro was founded in 1946. So I would have to look seriously young if I was a co-founder. So having said that, the last thing I'd say is that I'm a real history buff. And I really enjoyed the report and what it said about the historical links. And there are two things that I thought that I'd point out, which, again, are sort of one of those less known but interesting historical links with India and the U.S. So the first is that, the British, the viceroy that came to India that actually did the most in terms of, in some sense, creating a divide between the Indian population and the British was Charles Cornwallis, who came to India directly after actually submitting his defeat to George Washington. So it was really interesting that he learned his lesson that, we're not going to let another colony kind of get ahead of itself. And so we're going to keep it bottled up, which was interesting. I didn't realize that until I read this. And the second piece of historical trivia is that India owes a lot of its independence to the stuff that came out of San Francisco in the U.S. San Francisco is covered in the report with the Gadar Party and all, but I think that more importantly, it is not that well known that FDR was hugely responsible for maintaining pressure on Churchill, particularly on Churchill personally, but also on the British, for giving freedom to India that had been promised during the Second World War. And little known is the fact that at the Yalta Conference, FDR had a specific meeting with Churchill about making sure that they followed through on the commitment to give India its independence. So anyways, as you pointed out, Sean, the more you look, the more links you find. Thanks.
All right. My name is Arjun Batra, and I'm
with Intel based in Santa Clara, but for the last 7 years have been involved in setting up the operations in Bangalore. So I'll take it from a macro level of the history to more micro level, because that's what we build, microprocessors. So taking that, in Intel, we established, we had our presence in India since 1988, but that was more a sales and marketing presence. In 2000, we started doing a little bit of IT work, but we really recognized the potential of India in 2002. And you have seen in the report, when you read it, you'll find that the emphasis is on giving the Indian operations more of the innovative work, more of the challenging work, rather than the mundane work. But when we started the operations in 2002, we gave India a site to build a Xeon processor, which is our bread and butter technology. So we were not after India to create some mundane work. In order to get that kind of a work started there, we really couldn't find the talent, even though India's got a lot of engineers, but there were very few who were capable of building gigabit transistors over there at that time. So the brain drain recirculation, which we are talking about here, is really what allowed us to build the center there. Out of the 2,700 people we have in India today, 400 of those have come directly out of this valley. They have moved back. Some of them will come back because they're U.S. citizens now. They're Indian origin, but they're U.S. citizens. But they were at the right demographic structure that they could go back, have their kids study in Indian educational system. By the time they're ready to go back to the university, they're going to be back here in the Bay Area. So this brains recirculation was key to being able to make India Center a very successful center for us. Today, Intel India represents a microcosm of Intel, which means it does everything, whether a Folsom site does or a Santa Clara site or Oregon site. They do interesting work. They do some uninteresting work to keep us in business. And we are building our latest ultra-mobile group chipsets, microprocessors, everything in India, designing, not manufacturing. We have no presence of manufacturing there, okay? So most of work is done by the Intel employees. We do utilize some of the resources from the outside, but most of the 2,700 people are the ones who are doing the work in India. So we're not in a outsourcing in that sense. We are more an insourcing company. The future-wise, India has earned its status as like any other site in Intel. So they compete for the same project which Israel will compete, Folsom will compete, or Oregon will compete. And hence, they will get some of the next generation one or N plus one generation or N plus two generation. So it is now a total integral part of Intel's success and future lies on that one. We do build products for the global market as well as the local market in India, like the Classmate PC, which we are now selling globally, was originally designed in India and being manufactured in China, so we utilize all of the global resourcing capabilities. Two other areas I'd like to make comment on. When we started this work in India, culturally in India, even though we got lots of engineers, more engineers than anybody else, but people do not want to stay in the technical discipline. It's more prestigious socially to be a manager, to be able to go and say, I'm a manager, rather than say, I'm a technical individual contributor. We had to fight that very early on. We took some of the Intel fellows who are of Indian origin. We created a program called Fellow in Residence, which means that these guys were actually spending a lot of time in India to be a role model for these people so that they stay on the technical track rather than quickly after a couple of years they start moving towards a managerial track. We do need managers, but not as many as we needed the engineers. So we had to come up with some innovative programs to keep these people on the right track so that we will have the access to the engineering talent which we acquired to do the work. One comment I'd like to make on the policy area, Sean, which is pointed out about the great education and then people coming for the master's and the PhD here and then staying here, so freeing up the immigration bottlenecks which we have created for people being able to stay here. But we also have to address another area, which is domestic undergraduates being able to go to the master's and the PhD program. You take a typical IIT person, when he comes over here, he has zero loans on his account, while a typical undergrad from Berkeley would have about $20,000 of loans. Hence, they are more motivated and more compelled to go towards a job seeking so that they can pay off their loans. And hence, we have to find a way to capitalize on that ratio to improve. So in our policy area, I like the recommendations which have been made in the policies, saying that we need to allow more of the people to be able to stay here and create innovative jobs. We improve our math and science. We need to also pursue this area. How do we free up our undergrads to be able to go loan-free and be able to pursue master's and PhDs so that they can equally contribute? Okay, so that's my comments on the, but the report is extremely comprehensive. I learned a lot from it myself, even though having been involved and born, as you can tell from my age, for a long time with India. So I really appreciate this report coming out. Okay.
Well, thank you, Arjun. And, you know, my name is Sandeep Kishore. I am with HCL Technologies. I head the global R&D services for sales and practice. And, you know, Sean actually talked about 250,000 Indians who live in the Bay Area. We contribute to about 2,752 of them here. And, you know, Bay Area is our home. I've been here personally for 12 years plus now. And, you know, first of all, I really want to take this opportunity to thank the Bay Area Council of Economic Institute, Sean, Neil, you know, Jim, Lenny. The report, you know, actually this 295, 300 pages of report is a real fascinating and insightful, you know, piece of work, which I think is really a must read if you want to know about not only the relationship between the Bay Area and India, but about, you know, India itself, because, you know, it changes every so often. The 12 years that, you know, I have been here in the Bay Area, I can tell you that I have not come across any company which currently does not have a presence in India, either directly or indirectly, or is not thinking about, you know, having a presence in India, or, you know, is not considering of doing business in India. So in simple terms, you know, A plus B plus C equals to the universe of all the companies in Bay Area, in all organizations here. That simple fact, you know, which is so unique and so true about the Bay Area and India relationship. No wonder the relationship between the Bay Area and India continues to thrive and continues to rise. Last 10 years particularly has really catapulted India into a unique relationship with the Bay Area. You know, given the fact that it started, you know, just by doing simple technical work, but very rapidly it has moved on to being more complex work, you know, some of the work which, you know, you heard from Arjun a little while ago. And also the added dimension is, you know, the rising economy of India, the rising middle class, the rising consumer segment, which really provides a unique opportunity for the Bay Area companies to provide and give an expansion to their global market segment. The relationship between Bay Area companies and India is really unique and really privileged. It revolves, you know, around the engineering excellence. It revolves around the engineering prowess. Engineered in India is not only a way of life. You know, it is a philosophy which several Bay Area companies have really leveraged to be globally competitive in the marketplace. You know, engineering is core to India, and innovation is what drives the Bay Area. And it is this simple, you know, fulcrum of relationship which really has, over the last decade or so, given a new meaning to the relationship between the two regions. The next 10 years will see India really doing 4 to 5 times more on the engineering services than what it is today. That means about $40 to $50 billion worth of engineering relationships will be established between India, you know, and the rest of the world. And it is really for the Bay Area companies to take advantage, you know, of that capacity which is going to get created. The first wave was created by companies, you know, like semiconductor companies, Intel certainly being one of them, network telecom companies, Cisco, and software companies. the next, you know, decade will actually see companies, you know, from energy, from infrastructure, biotech, consumer. You know, there are several new industries which will get added to the capacity which India has, you know, created. And it is that supply-side equation which, when you merge it with the demand which we are all working towards in this global economy, really creates the unique relationship between, you know, India and the Bay Area. 2009, India will graduate over 300,000 engineers, which is two times more than what it graduated less than 4 years ago. That's the supply side which is available for the Bay Area companies to take advantage of. Complexities of work have significantly increased. You know, no longer are people or companies or organizations in India doing only low-level work, you know, which is fairly routine. More and more end-to-end product development, complete ownership of product, and including the business alignment, you know, where companies, and I think Sean mentioned about it, you know, are getting more strategically aligned with its ecosystems and partners today, where it is alignment at the business level, not just at the product level. So in short, I think it is about collaboration. It is about global reach. It is about finding that complementary balance. It is about innovation. It is about knowledge. It is about IP. And also about the cultural compatibility between the Bay Area and India. And I can tell you there is no better natural ally for the Bay Area San Francisco region than India. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Kaiser Mullah-Firoz, and I work at Salesforce.com here in San Francisco. Sean, thanks for the intro, and congrats to you and the team at the Bay Area Council for successfully publishing the report. I'm going to focus my comments today really more on the IT industry and actually more specifically on the software industry, and then talk a bit about the opportunities and challenges as I see for the indigenous IT industry in India, less for the U.S. companies operating in India, but more for Indian companies themselves, and potentially what role the U.S., India, and the Bay Area India relationship could play in this evolving sort of partnership. Now, to set the context just very quickly, if you look at the way the indigenous Indian IT industry has developed over the last decade, as Sandeep said, that's really the last 10 years have really been the period during which the IT industry has really sort of shot up in India. And if you look at that, you sort of step back and look at that, as it sort of moved from low-level Y2K work to moving to BPO and call centers, and more recently graduating to what's known as KPO, knowledge process outsourcing. If you still look at all of it, at the heart of it, India's IT industry is very much a services play. Even if it's moving up the value chain, it still very much remains a services play. And I think one of the challenges that Indian IT companies are going to face over time, obviously, with this focus on services, is more pressures on growth and profitability. On the one side, we're seeing that Indian companies are facing an increasing amount of price competition from low-cost competitors. On the other hand, as I think Sean alluded to, the labor cost arbitrage is, you know, certainly changing, if, you know, moving from 6-to-1 more to 2-to-1 in some areas, and that certainly changes the economics of the business. So I think over the long term, not just the next 5 to 10 years, but over the really long term, this is going to be a significant risk and a challenge for the Indian IT industry. And it really goes to sort of the foundation and the structure of the industry. So I think that is something that, you know, India needs to begin looking at, and potentially the U.S.-India relationship needs to begin focusing on. Now, clearly, today the sweet spot for India is IT services. But I think it also potentially sort of represents a missed opportunity in some ways. a missed opportunity to do higher value product development, R&D, innovation work, not just as an outsourced service for foreign companies and not just for the IBMs and the Intels and the Microsofts of the world, but also potentially doing this innovation within Indian companies, and not just the big Indian companies, but also in the context of startups and entrepreneurial ventures. And from my own perspective in the software industry, if you sort of look at the software industry, you today see really not much innovation happening in the software space. And, you know, despite the fact that India has a tremendous talent pool of software developers, but for some reason, the product mindset within the software industry does not exist. And again, just to clarify, I'm specifically talking about software, and this is in sharp contrast to some of the innovation we are seeing coming out of India in a number of other industries. In fact, you also have a term coined for it called reverse innovation now. Everyone's heard about the, you know, the $2,000 Nano, the $70 fridge. There's innovation in financial services and healthcare, in manufacturing. So India does have a tremendous culture of innovation and entrepreneurship, but somehow that hasn't really moved to the software space. And I think there are good reasons for it, but I think the big question is what are the hurdles and what can US and India do and how can we collaborate to really remove these bottlenecks and spur the same kind of innovation in the software industry. Now, if we sort of step back and look at what's been happening in the software industry and what are some of the hurdles, I think one of the key issues that we see is that to be able to build a software product and take it to market, that takes a tremendous amount of investment, and the payback periods are extremely long. The economics of the business is very, very different from running an IT services company. And I think that is one of the reasons why today the indigenous software industry in India is relatively undeveloped, relatively immature. Now, the reality is that things are changing with the internet coming around and, you know, the way companies distribute, sell, develop. I think a lot of these things are changing. And obviously, you know, from my perspective at Salesforce.com, I come to it with a bit of a bias towards cloud computing and software as a service. And, you know, we are beginning to see today a lot of small developers, a lot of small IT shops out of places like India, China, that are able to build products on a relatively low budget. And they not only build it, but also actually deliver it to end customers without necessarily investing in the huge infrastructure. And so I think this really opens up a tremendous amount of opportunities for collaboration between the US and India, and not just between the big companies, not just the TCSs and the HCLs and the Infosys of the world, but also for the small developers and also for the entrepreneurs in India. And we are beginning to see some of that, obviously, you know, with our own platform, Force.com, but that's not the only one. You have Amazon.com, you have Google's App Engine, you have Facebook, Apple, you know, Microsoft just came out with their cloud platform. So there are a lot of opportunities here, and I think this really opens up a tremendous potential for Indian developers to really move from working for other companies to also potentially becoming entrepreneurs. Now, before I end, just a quick comment. I also alluded to the fact about, you know, sort of capital availability. And it's true that a lot of venture capital firms have set up shop in India over the last 5 years. But from my standpoint, as I sort of see it, the venture business in India today is very different from what it is in Silicon Valley. Given the relatively large funds that we see in India, and the fact that there are a lot of greenfield opportunities in non-tech areas like retail, I think a lot of venture firms today in India are operating more like private equity firms. And there's nothing wrong about that, but it's a very different model from what is required to spur innovation and spur sort of startup activity. And NASSCOM, to its credit, has sort of realized that very recently and set up an India Innovation Fund to really try and promote this sort of startup and innovation activity within sort of the Indian startup community. So that, I think, is really one great opportunity for Silicon Valley and India to collaborate on. I think the innovation cycle And the entire ecosystem that we see, the supporting ecosystem around innovation that we see in Silicon Valley, it's something that's very, very highly developed here. And it's something that India really needs to sort of inculcate into its innovation culture over the years. And I think that presents a great opportunity for the two areas to really collaborate and try to sort of make some progress towards. Thanks.
Good afternoon. I'm Nandini Tandon, and I, too, would like to take this opportunity to thank Sean for inviting me and also complimenting Sean, Neil, Jim, and the rest of the team for boiling the ocean in such a succinct and effective manner that even we Indians can learn as to how we're going to be connecting the dots between the relationship between India and the San Francisco and Bay Area in particular. Also, a lot of good luck for your travels to India. We hope you come back, and that will be the genesis of yet another panel discussion to see how we have progressed. I would like to utilize the few minutes given to me to share with you three things. What is the status quo of the life sciences industry in U.S. and India? What is the future of the same in U.S. and India? And where does the convergence take place, and what are the forces that are working to ensure that we do have the emerging ties between San Francisco, Bay Area, and India, and how am I personally involved in that? So looking at from the status quo standpoint, it's a mixed time. It's a very exciting time for biotech industry, but it's also a very challenging time for biotech industry. I come from having worked with very large pharmaceutical, one of the largest, Glaxo, and also with small and big biotech. And with that backdrop, I'd like to say that the pharmaceutical industries, which until recently were dominating the field in life sciences, are going through their own soul searching, because as we all know, innovation is a creature that does not inhabit areas which have a lot of layers and layers of decision-making. For entrepreneurship, by default, you need to have a crucible where you can make quick decisions and where you can ignite the spirit of the people who are working in the small company, having that small company spirit rather than an 80,000-member team at Glaxo or Pfizer or Novartis for that matter. So after many decades of soul-searching, I think the dust has settled that as far as the entrepreneurial spirit and innovation is concerned, it ain't coming from big pharma. To give you the breakdown, that's right, so it's actually very good news for all of us. I too applaud to that, because at the end of the day, it's very good news for San Francisco, because this is exactly where biotech emanated it. This is exactly where, I mean, up the road from here, UCSF, and Genentech and Chiron, they are the pillars, and Stanford. So this is really the place where biotech was created, so to speak. And it's biotech which allows innovation. 70% of innovation in our industry is driven by biotech. Whereas the sales, so biotech innovation, I don't mean just the fact that they come up with new products, but also pharmaceutical industries acquire some of the biotech companies, and hence they acquire the innovation. The second thing is that in the pharmaceutical industry at large, what's happening is that they rely heavily on intellectual property products. And in the next several years, $70 billion of intellectual property products are going to evaporate. And so the pharmaceutical industry is looking to see how they can fill their pipeline with innovation. So, of course, they're going to turn to biotech. Why is it challenging then? So this is all good news. Then why is it challenging? It is challenging because, as we all know, there are no public markets. And if you don't have public markets, then you rely on acquisitions for exits for a venture capitalist like myself. I am a managing director with Lumira Capital, which is a $1.2 billion fund over the life of our different funds. And we are we have offices in Montreal, Toronto, Boston, and out here in Palo Alto. And for us, when we invest in biotech, we must have our eye on exits. And entrepreneurs, by default, would like to be serial entrepreneurs. They don't want to get stuck with that company forever, so they are also looking for that. And if you don't have public markets as a vehicle for an exit, then you are basically reliant on pharmaceutical companies, which is not a good position to be in. Well, we always have our ways around. Coming from business development, we make sure that we have several pharmaceutical companies on the table, and then we bid against each other. That's another story. Now, coming to the status quo in India, traditionally, India has focused on the generic area. And given that is the case, they have understood, so to speak, the scaffolding of the industry, but that's not the same as the spirit of the industry. And I was quoted, and rightfully so, that even though I would very much like to see investments made in India in the very near future, speaking for Lumera Capital and some of my other colleagues in the industry, it's very difficult to do that because unless you can have strong syndicate, we are very reticent to enter area because life sciences by default takes about a decade or if not more and several $100 million for a molecule to go to the market. So we're talking about a very different beast. Here the life cycles are not 6 months to a year. Here you're dealing with regulatory bodies that make you do clinical trials of 30, 40, 50, 60,000 people, which themselves can run several years. And we all know things that work in a mouse. We've all resolved the cancer in mouse. We're nowhere near resolving cancer in humans. So it's a very different ballgame. So with that backdrop, that's the status quo. Going forward, only good things can come out, primarily because the pharmaceutical industry is going to be more reliant on biotech. India, we all know, is more than 1.2 billion population, and so it is very self-sufficient when you think of it, and when you're looking at large markets, traditionally in pharmaceutical industry, and I think in most industries when we say, where are your largest markets? One doesn't have to think twice, it is USA. But not necessarily going forward, because if you're doing personalized medicine, then you bifurcate, trifurcate, you really dissect the market in many different ways. And actually, that plays to the strength of India because India has the Ayurvedic and homeopathic on its side, which by default looks at life in a much more personalized medicine format than one shoe fits all. I mean, for two decades ago, the drug that we were all using was safe in a 40-year-old white male, which I'm not so sure constitutes the majority of the population in the world. So a lot has changed in our industry. So I think going forward what's going to happen is that India's biotech industry, which right now is primarily looking at generics, is going to evolve. It will take longer just because our industry is regulated and just because a lot of it's very large amounts of money and time have to be invested. So it will take time. I have a feeling that it's going to evolve more through the confluence of engineering and life sciences. So I think we will stand on the shoulders of the IT industry and our engineering colleagues out here because medical devices, as we all know, where you have stents, where you are looking at putting artificial discs, which are semiconductor or biomaterials, those lend much more easily to India than when you're trying to create a molecule from scratch and come up with mechanism of action. And we also know that India's graduate program is not as strong as its earlier fundamental education, and most of this research comes out of the graduate program. So that is all looking positive. Vaccines is going to be strong. Diagnostics, personalized medicine, all of that area, India has natural strength and is going to benefit from. So the women's health, I'd like to touch upon. That's an area very close to me. I'm on the board of a company called U-Systems, which uses fully automated ultrasound. And as we all know, X-rays are incapable of looking dense breast tissues. They can only look at fatty tissues. These are occult lesions that X-rays cannot see. And nobody can stand up and say the MRI, the magnetic resonance imaging right now, lends itself to a popular usage because it's very expensive. So from all of that perspective, ultrasound really hits the right spot. It's the Goldilocks. It's not too expensive, and it also it's something that allows you to have the appropriate technology on your side. And for once, I can say that when we are looking at the largest markets are not in U.S. because 40 to 50% women out here have fatty. tissues, whereas in the Orient, it's 70%. In the East, it's 70%. So when you add up the population of India, China, Japan, Taiwan, I mean, it really the deck is shifted quite a bit. So we're looking to take U systems, and it's the only fully automated system on the market right now, and a lot of women have found out that they go to physicians, they have mammography, they don't find cancer, and then they subject themselves to ultrasound and they find third-stage cancer, so on and so forth. These stories are coming out more and more. So there's a lot of room there. Finally, I'd like to come to the point as to what's happening in building ties. I am on the board of Bay Bio Institute. The focus of Bay Bio Institute, you'll be happy to know, is to ensure that no matter what else is happening in the rest of the world, we sustain excellence and we keep the leadership position in San Francisco Bay Area. And I think that is important. Even though my heart, I have a very soft spot for India, obviously that goes without saying, I have strong bias there. I think it's going to be a decade or two before we can shift the dynamics where India will be more competing and less partnering. I think for the next 2 decades, India will be partnering more than competing with the U.S. in the life sciences arena, because India would need to lean on them. And I think that's important. The second thing that I'd like to share is that there's an organization called TAI that Sean referred to. It has a global board of trustees, because now we have 53 chapters, and the global board of trustees focuses on the global trends. And I recently got elected to be on that board of trustees, and my focus on TAI, working with 53 chapters, is to see how we can utilize the IT platform, which is very powerful for entrepreneurs at TAI, for life sciences. And with that in mind, for the first year in the 16-year history of TAI, at the global retreat in Jaipur on December 17th, going up to the 20th, we're having two panels. In the 17th, our focus is cardiovascular, which is the number one killer in the world anyhow, and definitely for Indians. And on the 19th, we have a panel on diabetes, which is, again, high proclivity, four times more probability of having cardiovascular if you have diabetes, and also obesity. So if you have obesity, you have cardiovascular and diabetes. All of that comes in one fat package, so to speak. So we are focusing on those two panels, and happy to note that Rob Califf, who is the head of the largest clinical research organization in cardiovascular in the world, is flying out to Jaipur. He's on the panel. And Dr. Mike Merson, who just came from Yale and World Health Organization to Duke to head the global health, is on the panel. And Naresh Trehan, who's the cardiovascular surgeon from Delhi, and he's also the surgeon to Manmohan Singh, is on the panel. The same thing is replicated on the diabetes panel. And what the focus is to make sure that Kanwal Rekhis and Deshpandes of the world, who are the legends in the Silicon Valley and in the Boston area, are going to bring their expertise to help us figure out how we can use the scaffolding, leverage the scaffolding of the Thai IT entrepreneurs platform to bring in engineers to work as a team, so we can have confluence of teams going across different faculties, so to speak, engineering, biochemistry, medical technology, public policy, to make this happen. And so once again, Bay Area is at the heart of making this happen. Thank you.
Let me say, after Michael speaks, we're going to give ourselves, for those who can hang in, another 10 minutes for your questions. So those of you who have to go, if you need to move on, go ahead, but we'll give ourselves a little bit more time at the end. Michael. Michelle, sorry.
Oh, it's okay. Thank you so much. Well, I will be brief. Well, we've been, my name is Michelle St-Pierre, and I'm Director of Planning and Urban Design for Gensler here in San Francisco. And we've been doing work in Asia for well over 10 years now, mostly in China, you know, for like at first. And we've been doing work in India now for the last 2-3 years, which has been a different experience than in China, but truly fascinating. And I can tell that as an architect, India is an amazing country to really let you work with. So it is estimated that India by 2022, when it will turn 75 years old, will have over 30 of its business company listed in the Fortune 100 firms of the world, and will account for 10% of the world trade. India is experiencing a massive urbanization coupled with a solid economic growth that is building a solid middle-class society with the ability to sustain a strong internal economy. To sustain that growth and to sustain the emergence of a solid middle class, India is facing some key challenges. For instance, we have witnessed through our work in India the ambitious program by the central government to solidify the overall education system in the country by building a series of academic campuses across the country to develop further the intellectual capital required to be competitive on the global marketplace, as many of my panel members I can discuss. These efforts are needed and fantastic. However, I believe that some of the biggest challenges India is facing have to do with the quality of life in its cities, which is an essential component of a dynamic and vital economy. The urban transformation of India, if not dealt with properly, could affect greatly some of the successes the country has achieved already. The population growth in India will be urban in nature, and the country will need to fully undertake additional public action to maintain sustainable growth for the cities. Recently, there was an article posted on the Internet speculating that by 2022, again, well in the lectern 75, there will be a need for up to 500 new cities to accommodate the urban growth in the country. Otherwise, if all that growth occurs in the existing cities, the living conditions of those cities will be untenable. This approach is somewhat too simplistic, obviously. I really believe that one needs to also accept that the success of the country to emerge as a global economic power resides in the success of the major existing cities like Mumbai and Delhi. Livability and sustainability of cities are critical to the success of the country. As Prime Minister Dr. Manmohan Singh said recently, if Mumbai fails, then India fails. Existing cities like Mumbai and Delhi have grown at an alarming pace in the last 50 years. Mumbai population has increased from 2.8 to 19 million people, while Delhi grew from 1.4 to 16.7 million people. That urbanization built on a weak infrastructure poses major planning and sustainability challenges for Indian cities. These are the challenges India is facing. Rebuilding and expansion of the public infrastructure, including water, public transportation, energy, and protection of the environment. In order to fully succeed in its goal to be a major player in the global economy, India needs to embrace a new paradigm as to how it views its urbanization. India's biggest challenge resides in the ability of the country to embrace and develop a strong attitude towards sustainability in all its aspects, economic, social, and environmental. Let's look at Mumbai, for instance, which we've been doing quite a lot of work like in the last year or so. For instance, the public infrastructure of Mumbai is operating at full capacity and beyond. If we look at public transportation, for instance, over 88% of the citizens of Mumbai currently utilize public transportation, which accounts for up to 5.6 million trips daily, which is phenomenal. However, the system is operating beyond capacity, and the emerging middle class, when transportation choice becomes available to them, will most likely choose to drive a car to commute to work, even though the congestion is also a major problem. In this case, the overall livability of the city is greatly affected, obviously. When it comes to public open space, currently Mumbai has 0.03% of its landmass devoted to public open space, while cities like, for instance, New York and London provide as much as 5 to 6% of their landmass to open space. So these are some of the issues that Mumbai is facing and is currently fully addressing through a major new planning effort as to how the greater Mumbai region needs to grow in the next 20 to 40 years. Mumbai is currently undertaking a massive public transportation project throughout the city, and Delhi also is currently completing a new subway system that will greatly enhance the overall quality of life in the city. These are extremely important projects that reflect a clear priority. The rapid urbanization India is undergoing is not that dissimilar to what we have witnessed in China, for instance, in the last 15 years. However, the process is quite different. While China benefits from a central government organization that has the ability to take rapid decisions and implement massive urban transformation, India, being a democracy, is more complex and more nuanced, not dissimilar to the U.S. democracy in that respect. So India, being a center for innovation, can create new model for partnership between the public and private sector. Key infrastructure improvements are required to sustain the growth, as well as a proactive role of the municipal governments to be active participants in the planning and design of their cities. The success of India resides partly in the success of the Indian cities to be livable and vital places. Through our work in India, we have been able to bring our expertise working with our colleagues in India on projects that promote the densification of Indian cities based on sustainable design principles that encourage public transportation, promote mixed-use development, and provide a rich network of open space and a meaningful public realm that offer a rich urban life for the citizens of these modern cities, that improve the overall living conditions of the citizens with better jobs, housing, and amenities. from our perspective, sustainable cities, and this is definitely the case for all major Indian cities, have the ability to evolve and sustain vitality across time. Indian cities must lead the move towards competitive advantage and sustainability by increasing the human development potential, enhancing economic sustainability with opportunity for employment and advancement for all, and provide opportunities for the brightest to promote innovation and prosper in the post-information age. Promote social sustainability with housing, healthcare, for a wide economic range. And very importantly, promote an approach towards the environment that addresses the biggest global challenge we are facing, climate change. The carbon footprint of our cities is a direct indicator of their livability. We are reliant on our cities to sustain us. We need to ensure their sustainable growth around life-enhancing experience, public spaces, and well-conceived urban infrastructure. India can lead the way worldwide in setting the stage for the creation of the truly sustainable cities by embracing innovation, just like it is already doing so in so many economic sectors. Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle. So we'll take 5 minutes for a couple of questions for those who can stay. I do want to note we were very enthusiastic in really loading up Vivek's resume. It's hard to do, but I think you were vice chairman of Wipro, so a pretty major footprint. And if I remember, Vivek, when you went with Wipro, you said they need to be here in the Bay Area. You need to be tapping into what's happening in Silicon Valley. Do you have any quick thought on that?
So when I took over the role of vice chairman of Wipro, I actually moved to the Bay Area because this is where the ideas are. And, you know, at the end of the day, you can't have a company that's only factory. And so what we did was build a very strong network here that allowed us to, frankly, look forward and be the company we needed to be.
Great. Quick questions. Anybody have a question? Right there, please.
Yeah, actually, I referred to it very slightly when I talked about the public policy issue, and Srinath Reddy, who is the head of public policy and works with Manmohan Singh, he will be at this panel. And yes, absolutely, for a country the size of India, the government's role is going to be critical, especially in the life sciences arena. If you look at vaccines, if you look at infectious diseases, it's absolutely critical that that happens. And in the Indian government already has taken many different steps in the right direction. One of them has resulted in All India Institute of Medical Science and the government and Stanford University coming together for creating a Bio India Design Program, where the idea is to bring the engineers and the physicians together to work under the government's auspices, so to speak, to see how going forward they can inculcate entrepreneurship early on in the medical schools rather than later.
This might be a good question to close on. Other comments from the panel? Arjun, please.
Yeah, from the Intel perspective, there are areas where government matters a lot to us because right now we are involved in building WiMAX networks, and that's a matter of spectrum getting from the government and the policy and standardization. And Indian government has to be very much open to those things. Otherwise, you can't build those high-bandwidth networks. Certain other areas in the design activities, you can probably do that, but you still need the government's, at least if not the support, you want them not to be an interference. Mm-hmm. In other areas, you need an active involvement of them to be adopting the standards and granting the spectrum and things like those. Okay.
And if I may be controversial for a moment, I think that Indian government has generally been viewed as being corrupt, unreliable, and not somebody you want to partner with. And I think that what is going to change that is, in fact, an accountability that they have to a citizenry that matters. And that change is happening. So as you look out there, it is the educated people of India that are actually rising to taking a much more active role in the governance of their cities and their municipalities that will bring this change about. At the end of the day, going back to the historical perspective, India had 100% suffrage in the very first day of its independence. It took the United States 60 years before more than 16% of its population had the right to vote.
If I could just add one more to build on what Vivek just said, I think just to give you an example of the intellectual property, which is critical to life sciences, for the longest time, India's government was seen as disingenuous.
that they would say that, yes, we will protect, but that was not happening. But to Vivek's point, it's when Kiran Mazumdar Shahs of the world came out to India. For them, it was not only a question of protecting the IP of the foreign land, but it was also critical to protect the IP of what is emanating from India. And the government is taking a very keen role in that and has truly made contribution in that area.
Well, if I can, you know, just, you know, provide a comment here. I remember, you know, there was a late minister of IT in India, Pramod Mahajan, who made a pretty interesting statement that the reason IT industry grew in India was because the government stayed out of it. But that, and it was true to a large extent, you know, but given the size, you know, it's almost a $50 billion industry today. And at this scale and size, I don't think any government can stay out of it. I mean, there are specific, you know, areas in which government needs to contribute, and you heard it from Arjun. The additional area which I think will be important, which is a great learning from China, is, you know, the investment focus which the government needs to do for the manufacturing segment in India. And along with that, you know, will come, you know, a host lot of, you know, incentives for the design and the engineering organizations as well.
That's probably a good point to end on. It's a quarter of, so for those who have questions still, bar the doors. You can not let our panelists leave until you get your question in. But with that, I want to thank all of you for coming. I want to thank our partners for being part of the project and thank our very great panelists.